If you like this podcast and would like to support us, please rate, comment, and subscribe.
And also, please subscribe to our YouTube channel.
And now it's time to get a unique slant on current events from your favorite half-Asian couple. Get ready to know what's happening in the world today with your hosts, Shane and Nico.
All right. It's just us. No, I'm kidding. So, what's up? What's happening?
Yep.
This is episode 36. I'm Shane.
And I'm Nico.
And we're very happy to have Scott Horton return. Very happy to have you on. What's going on, man?
Hey, how are you guys doing?
We're doing good.
We're hanging
in there.
Got to get up at 5 tomorrow, so.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah, good old waking up early in the morning. It's always fun.
All right. What's that about? Where are y'all going?
Well, you
might as well say
you
it.
You
right?
want to announce it, or do you want to just kind of keep it on the down low?
I hope there's not going to be people who are stalking us watching this. No, we're going to go see Dave Smith debate Nicholas Sarwark.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so that's going to be interesting.
Flying into New York tomorrow.
Yeah.
Very cool.
So yeah, that's gonna be a fun time. We know that you have your own debate happening soon, but we won't dive into that because you've mentioned it 1,000 times on other people's podcasts. So yeah. The main reason why that we wanted you on is because 9/11 happened 18 years ago, and we're still over in Afghanistan, if people don't know. I also wanted to kind of go over what Trump tweeted about this. I guess he has some kind of
secret meeting
or whatever that he was going to do. I'll go ahead and just, kind of go over that tweet and then kind of have your reaction after that. So here's his tweet. So I won't do Trump's voice, but anyway, it's unbeknownst to almost everyone, the major Taliban leaders and separately the president of Afghanistan were going to secretly meet with me at Camp David on Sunday. They were coming to the United States tonight. Unfortunately, in order to build a false leverage, they admitted to an attack in Kabul that killed one of our great, great soldiers. I don't know why I had to say great twice, but anyway. And 11 other people. I immediately canceled the meeting and called off peace negotiations. What kind of people would kill so many in order to seemingly strengthen their bargaining position? They didn't. They only made it worse. If they cannot agree to a ceasefire during these very important peace talks and would even kill 12 innocent people, then they probably don't have the power to negotiate a meaningful agreement anyway. How many more decades are they willing to fight? I don't know. How many more decades are they willing to fight? It seems like it's just a never ending thing. Cause Trump was, during the campaign, he was saying, we'll defeat ISIS, whatever. But then once that's done, we'll start getting our troops pulling out, whatever. He was definitely not Hillary. That's for sure. He was definitely more of the peace candidate, I guess, or more of the peace candidate or whatever. But
Bob McNamara is a hippie compared to Hillary Clinton. Let's not grade Trump on too nice of a curve. He doesn't deserve that much. But
okay, well, I guess
worse. That doesn't mean he was better. If you know what I mean.
Yeah, I guess I'm just trying to. I guess comparing him to Hillary is basically like comparing what.
No, I mean you're honest on there. Look, this is the war that he was always against for years. In fact. I quote him in my book on Twitter, actually defending Obama, who he hated with a pathology there. Mm-hmm. And yet when Obama was drawing down from the surge in 2012 and all the generals tried to pretend that, hey, we never said we'd be done winning by 2012. What are you talking about? We want to stay. Donald Trump on Twitter said these generals ought to be quiet and do as the commander in chief says here, man. He's right. Get out of Afghanistan, save that money, make America great again, blah, blah, blah. Way back then. So he believed it enough. And, I think it was just a political talking point. And yet it's obviously also correct. And so it's not very hard to see why he convinced himself that, you know, we really should end this war. Why would we have it? Obviously, we can't win. Obviously, the war's been lost since 2005 or whatever it is. And so what is there to fight for there? It's crazy. So anybody ought to be able to tell you that. And Donald Trump is anybody. And so, you know, when he first came into power, you know, they basically rolled him the same way they did to Barack Obama in 2009, where the generals just said, essentially, you have to do this. And he finally gave in. And, you know, it was, I think, pretty credibly reported that James Mattis had told him, you have to do this. And if you don't escalate now and you try to get out now, then anything that happens after this, I'm going to blame it on you and say, I warned you and it's all your fault and throw you under the bus. So that's the Secretary of Defense, one of the guys who was in charge of losing the Afghan war when he was in charge of CENTCOM, essentially blackmailing Trump. But then, you know, he got over that and McMaster and Mattis are both gone. He's saddled with Bolton, but he really has pursued peace talks for the last, you know, year and a half or so. He sent Zalmay Khalilzad, who is an extremely powerful American neocon, you know, studied under Leo Strauss and is a friend of Paul Wolfowitz and Richard Perle and all those guys dating back to the 1960s, and helped write the defense plan and guidance of 1992, was the former ambassador to Afghanistan and Iraq under George W. Bush, and helped pick Hamid Karzai to be the first puppet dictator or so-called president of Afghanistan under George W. Bush. And Trump sent him over there to negotiate this thing. And they essentially have a deal. You know, my book, I said, we shouldn't even try to get a deal because I can't imagine the Americans actually essentially signing what amounts to a surrender and an admission of total defeat and turn around and go home and leave the country to the Taliban. I figured it's better to just go. That way you don't have to shake their hands, which I know you don't want to do. Just go. And so, but instead, they've actually, you know, whittled the deal down to extremely minimal qualifications on both sides. The Americans will pull their troops out as long as the Taliban swear that they will keep Al-Qaeda and ISIS down and out of the country. And they're going to start with 5,000 and then eventually, which would bring us back to where we were when Trump took office, down to right around 8,000 to 10,000 troops. And then they're going to pull the rest out in another year, 15 months. And the deal was done. And, you know, Trump essentially was for it. And the Taliban, you know, had announced, they were basically calling their Shura Council together to put a rubber stamp on it. But their negotiators had decided on this. And then, as far as I understand, the meeting at Camp David, I don't know if it ever really was going to happen. Apparently, this was really a thing. They were going to bring one or more of the Taliban negotiators, and along with Ashraf Ghani, the so-called at least president of the government in Kabul, and bring them to Camp David. And this sounds like a pretty harebrained scheme to me. I mean, geez, it's been since Ronald Reagan, since we had the Taliban in the Oval Office, you know, you're going to bring these guys to Camp David. Yeah, that's supposed to be a little ironic and humorous, by the way. But anyway, you're gonna bring these guys to Camp David. And that was, you know, the symbology of all that, you know, became the talking point for all the people who were against it. But, you know, the idea was Trump was going to essentially foist the deal on Ghani, I think was the deal. Say to Ghani, look, me and the Taliban have this worked out. Now you and him work it out. And I don't want any trouble and kind of, you know, force it that way. Because see, of course, from the position of the Afghan government, as long as there's chaos, they figure they can get us to stay. They're afraid of what would happen if we leave. So they have an incentive, just like the South Vietnamese government, for example, had a big incentive to ruin any kind of peace talks between us and the other side because they're dependent on our power there and are afraid of the future. They're right to be. But so then, you know, of course, there's huge divisions inside the government and including inside the Trump White House about whether to do this. You got John Bolton as the national security advisor, who's going to always take the hawkish position on everything. And you have, you know, the entire rest of the national security establishment who essentially don't want to do this. And So then the Taliban gave them a great excuse to cite when they set off this suicide truck bomb. I think it was a suicide truck bomb in Kabul the other day and killed 16, including an American and a Romanian soldier. How do you like that? Some Romanian mom and dad just lost their son over America's war in Afghanistan because your government wants to be part of NATO for what? To make sure that you get nuked in the event of a war between us and Russia when they would otherwise pose no threat to you or your country ever? What the hell kind of sacrifice is that to have to make? But anyway, so an American and a Romanian were killed along with a bunch of Afghan civilians there in Kabul. And so, as you say, then Trump cited that to say, well, and then imagine being able to seriously say this without irony, with no self-awareness whatsoever, as the president of the United States addressing the Afghan Taliban insurgency and saying, how could they do something so violent just to so-called improve the strength of their negotiating position? Oh my God. Welcome to the 21st century of America's Afghan policy. This entire time. There's exactly what David Petraeus promised Barack Obama. It's exactly what McMaster and Mattis said to Donald Trump when he escalated this war 2 years ago. Is they said, you let us hit them hard for a little while longer, we'll hit them harder, and then when we negotiate, we'll be in a better position to negotiate. And of course, all along, that means innocent civilians being torn apart by high-velocity explosives ripping through their homes where they live. I mean, this is absolutely crazy. This is the, horror movie levels of violence beyond your experience or imagination, what these people are going through. And why? For the exact avowed specific purpose, not of defeating the Taliban, but just strengthening our position by some, unnameable percentage point before we negotiate with the Taliban. And now look at us having this conversation in 2019, when we have no leverage whatsoever. When the Taliban have all, everything going on their side. It's no stalemate. A stalemate would be an improvement. All the momentum is with them. All the strength of their position is with them. In fact, what happened was they should have stayed home the other day. They did one suicide truck bombing too far for American public relations purposes. They gave John Bolton a reason, and they gave Donald Trump something to latch on to back down. And I don't know. I mean, this could be the end of it. They say it's suspended for now, but maybe we'll get back to it. The Taliban website has a statement where they kind of ridicule him and say, that's sort of beside the point, but they say, this is a sign of inexperience that just because one bomb goes off, now your whole position is changing and things like, do you even know what you're doing up there? And this kind of deal. But they say, we remain open to talks. And we also remain, of course, open to fighting. And that's their deal. They're going to keep fighting until America agrees to withdraw the troops. That's what they've always said. And they're not changing that. And so, but they've also said, you guys want to meet back as soon as possible. We want to meet with you. They're not trying to play tit for tat on as far as shutting down negotiations. But you know what? You hear the Americans say this all the time. And I don't know how you say it in Pashto or in Urdu or whatever, but what the Americans say about XYZ enemy always is these people only understand one thing, force. And then we accuse our enemies of thinking that way about us, but then isn't that right? That the Americans only understand one thing, force. Why are the Americans negotiating with the Taliban at this point? Because it's either this or eventually a roof of Saigon panic, horrifying, terrible defeat, public relations disaster, like what happened at the end of the war in Vietnam. They lost the war and they know it. They're finally getting out while getting is good. And, even there was an Obama official wrote a piece in the Washington Post, of all places, saying, I'm sorry, folks, whatever deal we can get right now, we better take it. Because in 5 years, whatever deal we can get is going to suck and be worse. And whatever we can get now is as good as we're going to get. And you know what? Whatever deal we could have got 5 years ago would have been better. and whatever deal we could have got 5 years before that, and 5 years before that would have been way better. But now it is what it is. Now we got to go ahead and go, what are you going to do? Essentially, just as Donald Trump said, he goes, well, I could win the war, but I would have to kill tens of millions of people. And then he later repeated that and said, without nuclear, but still, and he's essentially correct. He's essentially saying, I actually almost had this line in my book and I took it out because I didn't want anyone to get it twisted at all that I was sarcastic enough or crass enough that I was like in any way suggesting this or anything. That the only way to win this war is to kill all of the Pashtun people. That's it. They're not going to give in. And America could kill them. There's no question that America could fly B-52s and we could carpet bomb Lashkargah and we could carpet bomb Kandahar, you know, city and province. And we could, you know, find whatever Pashtun villages in the south and the east of the country and reduce them all to rubble and kill tens of millions of people. And then I guess give the Kabul government another $500 billion in order to try to prop up their regime to come and conquer those lands. I don't know, salt them to keep the, you know, anybody from ever coming back. If that's the way America wants to do business, like the Golden Horde or worse, then I guess we could do that. Otherwise, the game's already up. And this is what Trump should have said his first month in office. He should have said, guess what? George Bush and Barack Obama already lost the Afghan war. It's not my fault. I just got here, but it's too late to fix. And certainly not at any reasonable price in lives or in dollars. And that's it. And we're done. There's no reason he had to escalate this thing at all. And there's no reason really why he needs to make a deal with the Taliban. Just come home. Pack up the Bagram Air Base. Pack up the CIA. Get the hell out of there. And by the way, if you read the New York Times, Gina Haspel, bloody Gina Haspel at the CIA is saying she doesn't want to stay. She's saying, hey, look, CIA can do counterterrorism missions all day as long as we have the American military to provide air support and to provide medical evacuation support and to provide logistical support and weapons. And in other words, saying, yeah, we can do it as long as everyone else stays with us, too. In other words, we can't do it. So forget it. And they're also, the CIA is saying that, don't give me this BS about Afghan ISIS. They're nothing but local Pashtun fighters, and they don't pose any threat to the United States whatsoever. That's the position of the CIA in the New York Times, kids, right now, that we can go. The safe haven myth is BS. The military might cite the safe haven myth, but the CIA themselves aren't buying it. And I say, anytime you can cite the CIA truthing you out of war instead of lying you into one, then that's all right.
So you're saying the CIA, the one that's been all up in, you know, what is it the CIA or maybe the FBI? I don't know. Maybe they're all in cahoots. I have no
idea. They're so flush with heroin money now, they don't need any more, I guess.
But I was just saying that. So this is the same CIA that's saying, oh, maybe we should, you know, like you're saying, get out or whatever. Like, I mean, Gina Haspel, that like you were saying, you know, we should get out or whatever. This is the same CIA that was like the whole Russian collusion thing, or is that like FBI, or is it all the same thing? Isn't that kind of weird though? If they're saying that they're going against him again, like, with this issue too, or.
No, they all have their own interests, you know?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Yeah,
you know, I think the CIA is basically worried about getting stuck with Afghanistan, you know, that the military is going to get out and that everybody's going to say, well, let's just leave the CIA there. And they don't want the mission without everybody else's support. I mean, after all, that's not just an excuse to get out of doing your homework. That's a real problem. If you have American CIA officers on the ground and they don't have American drones protecting them in the sky, and they don't have whatever other American support that they would get from the military, especially medical evac support and this kind of thing. Without that, they don't want to fight. Why should they? And especially when the whole thing is this big, stupid joke that they could have ended a long time ago anyway, and they all know it. So, you know, I think the real problem here is, and it's funny because in all the debate about Afghanistan right now, what you won't hear anybody say is we should have ended this war all along. And everybody who said so in 2004, or pick a year out of the hat in our recent past, everyone who said that then, they were right then. And everybody who argued and everybody who said, no, we have to stay, you were all wrong this whole time. You got all these people killed for nothing. You were wrong. It was wrong. Now here we are. We have to leave. And all of these people died. And what did you get for it? Other than you were able to put it off. Some military officers were able to put it off until it was somebody else's fault. You know, David Petraeus is writing articles in the Wall Street Journal saying, oh, no, we can't stay now. Oh, you're betraying our whole all our great successes. Well, David Petraeus said he was going to win this war and he was going to bring the Taliban to the table with the bloody nose. And they were going to sign what he told them to sign back in July by, I promise, President Obama, by July of 2012, I will have them at my mercy. Yeah, well, guess what? July 2012 came and went. And David Petraeus did not deliver bloody, whimpering, submissive Taliban signatories to come and end this war on America's terms. He failed. And you know what? After the great journalist Michael Hastings brought down William McChrystal, Stanley McChrystal. I don't know where I got William from. After McChrystal was brought down, they were going to use that as the excuse. Oh, well, see, the counterinsurgency strategy of the brilliant American General Petraeus, it would have worked fine if only that dastardly investigative journalist Michael Hastings hadn't done such a great job doing his journalism and such. But then Barack Obama demoted Petraeus from the commander of CENTCOM, put him on the spot right there in the White House, Oval Office, in front of everyone, and said, David, I'm putting you in charge of the war. Mr. Counterinsurgency Manual, Mr. This is all, you're the only one who can do it. I'm calling your bluff, pal. And so Petraeus had no choice but to say, yes, sir, sir, and accept his demotion from head of CENTCOM down to the level of general in charge of the Afghan war, where he proceeded to lose it. And then you know what he did? He went to the CIA, where he tried to force them to write reports about how successful the Afghan war was, and they wouldn't go along with it. And they ended up leaking all of his crimes of leaking secrets to his hoes to the FBI, who prosecuted him and overthrew him. And that was like an internal CIA coup against Dave Petraeus because they hate him as much as I do.
So, I mean, like, kind of going back to the like Trump tweet or whatever and saying, you know, about the Taliban did this, I can't believe they would do this. And then he's trying to make a deal or whatever. It just seems like, you know, like with, it just seems like another failure, or at least of right now, it's just another, because like you were saying, you know, he was going to end the war or whatever, you know.
Well, to me, it just seems like an excuse not to have peace talks, you know, like just this one thing happened.
Right. Yeah, that's a good
probably
point.
I think that's right.
Him, you know.
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, that's why, you know, like if you're okay. So that's why a lot of people, especially libertarians, but I'm sure even other people were like, you know, why why of all people would you put John Bolton in your fucking, just, like, you know, like why would you do that? Like, I thought you wanted to end this, and yet you have like the biggest hawk that there is, you know, and it seems like he's only a national security advisor. I don't know how high up that is in terms of like a cabinet or anything like that. But at least for the Middle East, he seems like he has a really big mouth in terms of his, you know, how loud his voice can, you know, conjure up and stuff. Because,
but and it's all the rest of them too. I mean, essentially, there's no one who's really part of the permanent government who wants to tell him that, yeah, we should go ahead and go.
But I would rather
retire first and let it all fall apart on somebody else's watch later. Kick the can down the road and then get your retirement.
But then like with the Korean talks, whatever, you know, everyone was kind of like saying, well, maybe this is the beginning of the end for Bolton, then, because, you know, oh, Bolton's going to Myanmar for some reason or whatever, because Trump's bringing him there because he doesn't have anything to do with the Korean talks. Mm-hmm. But now it seems like that's kind of up in the air. Who knows what's going to happen there, even though it seemed like, you know, little baby steps happening. Oh, Trump.
Well, you know, I mean, think of that. Yeah, man, I just posted this thing today. There's some Bloomberg article, I guess.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, because look at this. Trump, Mr. Dealmaker, hasn't been able to close a single deal.
Right.
You know, they made cosmetic changes to NAFTA with Mexico. That essentially was nothing. But the trade deal with China, they're just waiting him out. They're not giving in to him at all. He's achieved nothing there. He doesn't have a deal in Korea. He got out of the nuclear deal with Iran and cranked up all these sanctions, saying he's going to get a better deal out of them. they're going to come to heel. That hasn't happened. He's got the deal of the century to somehow bribe the Palestinians into giving up the last vestiges of their independence and sovereignty that are any hope of ever having any on the West Bank. And even that, all they've debuted is half the plan. And Greenblatt, the senior envoy there, has just resigned his position before they've even debuted the political part of the plan because it's so dead on arrival there. Venezuela, they tried this fake-ass coup to install this guy Guaido. They got no deal whatsoever. They got no traction whatsoever. They've got no positive results of that. You know, nothing came out of that whatsoever. What am I leaving out? Afghanistan, they got no deal now. It's falling apart. And, you know, here's why Afghanistan is really hard, too. Because, see, in Syria, he could have said, I don't care what y'all say, we won. You know, yes, it's true that it's Barack Obama's fault that ISIS was able to conquer all of eastern Syria and western Iraq. But then again, Barack Obama also launched Iraq War III, and Donald Trump finished it, and the Islamic State is smashed. It does not exist anymore. Syria is once again Syria, and Iraq is once again Iraq, and the Islamic State between them no longer exists. We win. Have a ticker tape parade. Hooray. Bring the guys out of there. If Trump was man enough to stick with his decision and face down all the hawks on that one, he at least had a very compelling narrative that America actually won one for a change, in a sense. But of course, there are other interests involved in keeping us in Syria. But anyway, the point I'm making is, in contrast, in Afghanistan, we lost. In Afghanistan, the bad guys are walking around all over the place doing whatever they want, killing policemen, killing soldiers, ransacking cities, you know, seizing whatever weapons they want from old American and Afghan army bases. They're not just, you know, destroying the municipal governments. They're just taking them over. They're putting all their own people in charge of all the schools, in charge of all the bureaucracies and all the police agencies and all the, you know, bureaucratic offices in the small towns. And they're, you know, they run about 60% of the country. And so America is, there's no other way to put it, we're losing. In fact, in that first big scandalous book about Donald Trump, Fire and Fury, Dina Powell, who was from, I think, Goldman Sachs, one of these investment banks, she was General McMaster's right-hand man on the National Security Council, the deputy national security advisor. And her quote was, look, if we leave Afghanistan, then that means Donald Trump lost a war. And Donald Trump can't lose a war.
Yeah.
In other words, it's just politics. It's just like LBJ on the phone going, well, I'm not going to be the first American president to lose a war. Meaning, you know, let another couple million Vietnamese and another few tens of thousands of Americans die over there, and it'll be Richard Nixon's fault later, not mine. And that's the same kind of thing that they want to pull now, even though, man, we're, as you said, we're in our 18th year here. This is really, and it's so frustrating the way the media portrays all this. That, like, well, geez, David Petraeus writes in the Wall Street Journal that we better stay. We can't have a precipitous withdrawal. Precipitous withdrawal? How can anyone say that without laughing? It's 18 years. We lost. What's precipitous? You know, Marianne Williamson, the hippy-dippy flower child scented candle lady running for the Democrat thing, said, oh, no, we can't stay. We can't betray the Afghan people who, you know, Amy Goodman, get this. Eric Garris from AntiWar.com told me he heard Amy Goodman on Democracy Now! Interview some Afghan lady activist saying, no, please, America cannot abandon us now after all you've done to create this wonderful democracy for us. And that Amy Goodman just sat there and took it the whole time and never said anything about, like, yeah, but, you know, the American military has to keep killing these people with such violence in order to prop up your power. Like, I don't know if I want to continue with this. Instead, Amy Goodman is like, yeah, that dastardly Donald Trump, boy, we don't like the things he does, like trying to get us out of Afghanistan. And this is the position of Amy Goodman on Democracy Now! People have lost their minds over this thing. But, you know, again, we lost. So, I mean, this woman that Amy was interviewing was right that there's going to be hell to pay. I don't know for sure that the Taliban are going to try to take the capital city, but they might. And I don't think that the Afghan government, as we've constituted it, can survive. So think of it just like Austrian economics and the economic bubble. So, you know, the Federal Reserve prints all this money and to prop up the power of American military power and CIA power to prop up these favored political factions, you know, with military might and with paper dollars. But then when we withdraw that military might and all that influx of inflationary money to prop them up, the value of their power plummets. There's a massive correction coming. And, you know, the Kabul government is basically like the housing market in 2008, and it's ready to crash. And what's going to come after that? It's going to be ugly as hell. And so, you know, it'd be nice if we had a leader with a little bit of moral courage to say, you know what, tough. I'm sorry. That's still everybody else's fault but mine. I'm the new guy. And after all, because Trump wasn't even, never mind a senator, he wasn't even a governor. I mean, there's no way in the world you can pin this on him. I mean, look at his opponent was the wife of the guy who helped put the Taliban in power in the first place in the 1990s. Right? I mean, she was up to her eyeballs in all of this stuff. He's the new guy. He could just show up and be like, I don't care what the last principal told you. From now on, we're running the school like this. I'm new in town. It's who knows? You know, I'm not responsible for anything before. But of course, Donald Trump is one, a bad person, and so self-interested and so devoid of any kind of wisdom or morality. It doesn't even matter. He's against the war just because he's kind of sick and tired of it. But that's not much of a feeling, sick and tired. It doesn't amount to much. And
when he talks about like when he's against the war, it's usually about how much we're spending. It's not usually, we're losing so many people. It's like, you know how much money we're spending and over there, right. Bush and Obama, like, come on, look how much we're in debt because of them or whatever. Right.
And like to him, in his mind, probably like on the plus side, we are bombing people. So we're making money selling bombs and that's fun. You know, you get to have it, you know, I get to strut around and be a macho tough guy leader for being violent and killing people and live vicariously through all that macho stuff for our great, great, great soldiers out there doing that tough guy stuff. And, you know, that's the thing about him, right? He never was even any kind of libertarian. At best, he's some kind of right-wing populist. And that means that, you know, he might be some kind of deficit hawk sometime, but that'll always be drowned out by his regular hawk, you know, his yearning for violence. You know, I went to the Young Americans for Liberty conference here in Austin the other night, and they had this Congressman Chip Roy get up there and give his big, you know, Liberty Republican speech, where he just said with a straight face and no irony whatsoever, and I think the crowd pretty much bought it, that like, yeah, after we pay for our wonderful military to protect us and pay all the interest on all that debt to do that, and once we take care of Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security, then by God, we need to balance this budget. We need to really start cracking down. And it's like, yeah, I mean, this is what counts for a libertarian Republican, essentially, is like, just say the word deficit a couple of times or something, and then I won't notice that you have no problem whatsoever with $1 trillion a year national security state and a world empire seeking enemies wherever it can possibly find them, overthrowing governments everywhere. Of course, Ron Paul got up and gave a great speech and talked about we need to abolish the CIA. No proud free society should ever have a CIA. Right, kids? And they all go, yeah, you know. But, you know, I don't know. It this stuff sure does go without saying that, you know, the whole thing has to continue on even after all this time. It's you know, look. It's pretty hard when the burden is on us to say how it's all going to work out if everybody just does it our way. And the real answer is it's not going to work out. It's going to be ugly as hell, but it's going to be ugly as hell sooner, not later. And that's not too much of an improvement. But again, that's not the libertarians' fault for getting us into this. You know?
Yeah. I don't know. I guess kind of like when, well, I don't know, maybe not so much Bush. I don't really remember all that, but, you know, he was like, you know, we don't need any more nation building, whatever that whole during the campaign or one of the debates that he did with Al Gore. And then Obama being the dub that he was. And then, you know, of course, that turned out to be a, you know, whatever it was. But then you know, with Trump, it's, I don't know, maybe because, oh, maybe, you know, like you were saying, you know, well, you do it. Everyone was saying, oh, he's an outsider. He's not, he wasn't in the political game or whatever, you know.
They got him pretty fast.
Yeah, that's true. It's like, yo, he's been compromised the first day he got in there. You know, it's like they showed him all, you know, like that whole conspiracy theory where they show him all the, you know, this is what really happened to Kennedy, you know, and, you know, or something like that, you know, some weird stuff like that. So I don't know, like, you know, especially now with the election coming up, I mean, what does Trump really have that can, he can really grasp and be like, see, this is what I have that we, you know, I mean, I, the things that I can think of is be like, well, we're building the wall now. It's like, well, yeah, but you kind of were saying this was going to happen and then that never did happen. And now this is happening. And it's like, oh, are we going to,
and we're still in a trade war with China, right?
Oh, so. Yeah. Trade war with China. You know, I mean, the, like I was saying, you know, mentioning earlier, the Korean peace deal, but a lot of Americans aren't really, I mean, sad to say, but they're not, that's not like their number one issue is, oh, what's going on in Korea? Oh, yeah, I want to vote for who, you know, who am I going to vote for president because of that? Most of them are going to say, you know, am I going to get more money in my paycheck? Am I going to have a job? You know?
Yeah. And although, if he ended all of them, if he said, look, here's what we're going to do. We're going to end a war every 3 months between now and election day, and we got plenty to spare. So we're going to get out of Afghanistan. We're going to get out of Yemen. We're going to get out of Iraq and Syria. We're going to stop bombing Libya. We're going to pull all of our special ops guys out of Africa. We're going to pull our troops. Well, maybe wait till after the election and pull troops out of Eastern Europe. But, you know, a massive drawdown in the Middle East, he could just order it. And he could run as Trump the Great. I think he would win in a landslide. I mean, all other things being equal, I think he would destroy the Democrats. And then this would be the best part of it, right? Is that he would leave all of the stupid Democrats sputtering that, well, Donald Trump is endangering our security by entering all these wars, and we can't have that. And the Democrat voters won't know what to make of that, and they won't stand for that. The Democrat voters, they just don't lean hawk. They just don't. And to have the Democrats attacking Trump from the right for irresponsibly withdrawing from the world and all that would be a fatal way to undermine the Democratic Party, to force the leaders of the Democratic Party to shoot themselves in the foot so bad, to sabotage themselves on his behalf. But he's too stupid and venal and cruel and wisdomless. And I mean, hell, he's just blind as a damn bat is what he is, or else he would do that.
So do you think so? Yeah. The like the media spin on that would be crazy because they'd be trying to say that.
Oh yeah,
that he's, gonna, that, yeah. Like they'd be attacking him for it, right? So you don't think that people would be influenced well, by that because
well they try. I don't. Well, I think it was his favor
because like Trump, like I mean I don't know if I'm sure you know, but like Trump wants to be loved. Like that's the whole thing. That's why whenever the scene, he always talks shit about CNN because that's all they do is talk shit about CNN. Mm-hmm. But what's the only time? Or at least one of the rare times where they actually do talk about him, you know, positively, yeah. Is when he did that Syria strike. Oh man, it was great.
You know what's better though?
Wasn't it Dan Jones who was saying like he was presidential?
Oh yeah, no, they all did. They, you know, many of them said tonight Donald Trump becomes a president. Like why? Because he's bombing the Shia in Syria on behalf of Al Qaeda in Israel. Wow, what a hero. Over some false flag Al-Qaeda gas attack. Give me a break. These people are crazy. But the thing of it is, though, is the soldiers agree with us. And that was, I don't know if you guys saw this poll that came out about a month ago where the American people and the veterans counted up as a separate group. And this is, pardon me, this is veterans of the Iraq and Afghan wars, not just veterans overall. Veterans of the Iraq and Afghan wars, they, like the American people, are right around 64% in favor of ending all the Middle East wars, totally against them. And so if Donald Trump wanted to play it that way and wrap himself in the American flag of the, as he always puts it, the great, great, wonderful, heroic, freedom fighting for brave, wonderful, golden idol soldiers that he worships and that he wants to bring peace to protect them, that they have carried this burden long enough and that will be enough. And out of respect for them, he's going to end the war. That's the right wing take. That's how you do it. And that's how he talks anyway. And in fact, I mean, look at who we're talking about. It's Donald Trump. So he can be so hyperbolic. He could literally just sit there and go, oh, the soldiers, oh my God, the soldiers, how much I love them. I mean, that's how he talks, right? No one has ever loved the thing like I love the soldiers. Yeah. And he just say all that while he ends the wars. And everyone will essentially believe him that, you know what, he's honest about that. There's no hypocrisy in that. He does. Absolutely. He's that sort of a patriot, right? Who he would never be in the infantry, but boy, does he love some of them infantry guys, all right? You know what I mean? And so he's the perfect one to do it that way. But again, he's just, you know what? If he could like borrow 10 or 12 IQ points from you guys and a little bit of morality from, say, any scumbag off the street or anything, you know, he might be able to suss this stuff out for himself. But look at who he's surrounded by and look at, you know, the different guys in Herman's head up there in his own brain. He can't do this stuff, man. And he doesn't have anyone to help him figure it out either. So
he seems very easily influenced by the people he keeps around him. That's why I'm just like, why would you choose John Bolton? Like, why?
Well, yeah, because whenever
the answer is because Sheldon Adelson insisted. And in fact, John Bolton called him to sort of audition on Sheldon Adelson's cell phone. So Trump answers it thinking he's going to talk to Sheldon Adelson, the, you know, pro Likud, you know, Israeli, American Israeli billionaire. And it's John Bolton on the line. Hi, Mr. President. I'm here in Sheldon Adelson's office. And we were talking about how much we agree with you about withdrawing from the Iranian nuclear deal. So as soon as you're done getting rid of McMaster, you got my number. It's over here at Sheldon Adelson's office. And that's basically a done deal right there. Because John Bolton, he's not a neoconservative. He's a lifelong right winger, but he's extremely closely tied with all those Likudniks. It always has been. People mistake him for a neocon all the time for that reason. So That was how he got the job. And that was why Trump accepted him. You know, again, he never really was a dove. Just like you said, he sort of, you know, he thinks it's too expensive. Think of Donald Trump as essentially any old, very rich, right-wing, retired golfer type who sits around watching the news and going, ah, I can't believe this, blah, blah, blah. You know what I mean? It's a reaction against what is obviously absurd. How can we be at war for 20 years to try to hunt down and kill 400 guys? Does that sound right to you? A stateless group of terrorists and USA, number one, the global superpower, just can't seem to do a damn thing about them. You know, it doesn't feel right to anyone, and that includes to him. But that doesn't mean that he has then any substance or any kind of coherent way of thinking through these things or, you know, applying a real kind of, you know, a coherent, you know, Trump doctrine to winding them down. He's just sort of kind of sick and tired of it. So look at what happened last December. He announced we're going to go ahead and draw it down from Syria and Afghanistan. And the military essentially just said, no, we're not. And he goes, okay. And that was it. You know, all the think tanks and the hawks in the administration and the Israelis, of course. And there were a bunch of articles where the Israelis were like, oh no, America's abandoning us. America has to stay in Syria in order to protect us here in Israel. Oh, really? Because that's not how they sold it to us back here. I thought we were fighting evil to protect the innocent civilians from the terrible terror murderer guy. I see. This is all about Israel, huh? And then that was it. He just backed right down again. You know, it's not like he's Ron Paul where he's like, you know what? I've been reading about this and I've been thinking things through. And I'm really, really serious. And I don't care what you say about me. I don't care about the dissent. I made my decision. And it's time to pack up your stuff and come home. And those are, in fact, your orders. And you will obey them. And that would be that. But instead, you have Doofus, the Fox News watching golfer, who this is the best he can do, essentially, Nico. He, you know, this is him trying, you know.
He's trying really hard while he's, you know, I'm going to go swing out a 75 over on, you know, par nine over there or whatever, or something like that.
That means.
Yeah. Well, because, well, you were mentioning before, last thing before we end, but you were mentioning about the poll that you were talking about earlier about how the veterans, you know, the Iraq and Afghanistan veterans and I guess just whoever they polled, you know, that day, whatever, saying, you know, do you want to get out of the war or whatever? Or I don't know. Was it specifically the Afghanistan war or was it just all the wars that were in general?
Yeah, I forget the exact question, but Okay. It was essentially over the war on terrorism, wanting to end the whole engagement there. Yeah. Or at least regretting the Afghan and Iraq wars, like that. Should we have done them? One of those kind of questions. I forget exactly.
Yeah. So, you know, you mentioned that and you say, oh, there's a majority, or, you know, a pretty big majority of people saying, yeah, it was a mistake. We should leave. Mm-hmm. I mean, if I was like a Trump supporter or whatever, like 100% Trump, you know, I want this guy to win 2020, whatever, you know, I think he's doing great. Hey, look, here's a poll where you're at, you know, you're the president, but, and yet still they don't, you know, and they know that you originally, I don't know how you are now, or, I mean, your instincts seem to be okay, I guess, in terms of wanting to get out or whatever. Mm-hmm. Here's a poll that is basically agreeing with your an instinct to get out. Oh yeah, it was a mistake, whatever the reason was, and whatever, if you think it was too expensive, you know, I mean, obviously the more would probably be, obviously we're losing men and women over there, you know, but yeah, it's whatever. But then, you know, because I was listening to Pete's podcast with Biting the Bullet guys, they did just recently, and, you know, they're Marine vets and they're saying, yeah, don't join the military, you know, because this is the type of stuff that you're going to be finding yourselves, you know, getting yourself into. Is that
the reality is, though, man, look at it from Trump's point of view, politically speaking,
right?
What makes sense for him is to keep the donors happy, keep the national security state happy, keep the arms industry happy, keep all the power factions happy by staying at war, and keep the right-wing anti-war sentiment essentially placated by saying an anti-war thing every once in a while that he doesn't mean. It's worked perfect for him all along. We sat here this whole interview talking about, geez, if only he really meant what he said and whatever, but of course he never did, and he never is going to. It was never about that. It was just essentially about jerking everybody's chain and getting us to say, which is true, hey, at least he's not Hillary Clinton. But she's absolutely, and is certainly as president, would be the worst person in the entire world. So that's really not a very good comparison. That's like the best curve you could ever be graded on, is up against her on anything. You know, she probably would have had us all killed in an H-bomb war with the Russians by now over their refusal to let her put Al-Qaeda in power in Damascus. So,
yeah, gosh, she would have been the first woman president. So, you know, you got to have, you know, well,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah. But, you know, for Trump, he goes, look, and this is always his thing from the very beginning, was to say, you know, look, here's what we're going to do. We got to get real. We're going to have to cut Medicare and Medicaid in order to shore up the budget deficit. Okay. And then he would turn right around and go, I will always protect Medicare and Medicaid for the old people. And then he would go, look, man, we got to go to Mars. And then he would go, man, we should get rid of this whole space program. It's such a boondoggle. And he'd go, man, we got to get out of these wars, these stupid wars. We should have never been in the wars. I'll tell you what we're going to do. We're going to bomb them, and we're going to bomb their families, and we're going to torture them. We're going to kill their sisters, and we're going to be the most merciless killers that God ever saw on this planet, because, yeah, we got to end these wars. They're crazy. And then he goes, and then he just goes on to the next one, and on to the next one, and on to the next one. And there's nobody who's ever been more pro the LGBT than me. God, I hate them queers. And then on and on and on, I'm brought up both sides out of his mouth all the time, no matter what. So that, you know, if you're credulous, then you will say, ah, wow, I like some of the things he says. And then you can just ignore the rest. And after all, he's Donald Trump, so you got to kind of shrug. But if you like hearing the stuff that you like hearing, and you don't focus so much on all the contradictory stuff, then he sounds like he agrees with just about everybody. You know, he's got something for everybody, and he's always been like that. It's a deliberate strategy, and it works very well, you know?
It's probably that whole thing that you were talking about before, where he likes to be liked by people. So how do you get everyone to like you? You agree with, yeah, everyone.
That's why I went, you know, we were talking about how he shits on CNN and MSNBC all the time, because that's what they constantly do, is a shit on him. And then with Fox News, he's, you know, he's like rubbing him out one, you know, it's like, cause they're always, you know, Sean Hannity, oh, he's the greatest president we've ever had, you know, or what's her name? Laura Ingraham. I mean, Donald Trump's the greatest president ever. I mean, who's the guy before? Who knows? Who cares? Donald Trump's our president. Yay. Yeah. You know, so, but what does CNN do? Oh, he's a racist. He's bad. Blah, blah, blah. And he's just like,
you know, what's ironic. Like, he likes to be liked, and he takes all these different positions or whatever, but mm-hmm. he seems to be still like hated by so many people anyway. So like, why care about other people?
Well, some people were saying that, you know, him being president, and because I mean, before he became president, you know, he was in, you know, Home Alone 2 and, you know, all these movie cameos and all these television shows. Man, he was loved. Everyone loved Donald Trump, or, you know, at least on the public image. Yeah, you know, oh, wow, he's cool. The Apprentice, wow, that's a really neat show. I want to watch that. It's been, I guess that's how business works. Okay. You know, but then he, I guess, you know, and some of us were saying, well, he pretty much just threw all that likability away to be, you know, run for president because Obama was such a bad president that he decided, I'm going to run and I'm going to do something about this. What's going on in our country? And then Ann Coulter goes on Bill Maher and Bill Maher says, who do you think has the best chance to become president? And what does she say? I mean, out of the declared ones, I don't know, Donald Trump, and everyone laughs at her like she's a fucking idiot. Now look where we're at, 2019. I can't believe it. Donald Trump's a president. I mean, he might have another year left. Maybe he has a second term. Who knows? But
I think he's going to win re-election. I mean, you look at how horrible these Democrats are.
Yeah.
Probably the strongest candidate they have is Elizabeth Warren, and she's a ridiculous joke. Oh, Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden are both way too old and have so many other problems.
Isn't that kind of funny? How
it's hilarious, actually.
Because they would say, like, you know, we need all this diversity, and, you know, and however you feel about that, whatever. But that's just what they all say, you know, the left, the Democrats. Oh, we need this and that. And then who's their top three candidates? You know, Joe Biden, who, what's his platform? Oh, Charlottesville. Oh, really? Okay, whatever. That's not even a platform. Elizabeth Warren, who was like, what? She did a DNA test or whatever because Trump told her to, and then found out, oh, she isn't really a Native American. Wow, that was a big bust. Good job. And what's going to happen if Elizabeth Warren becomes a nominee? You don't think Donald Trump's going to harp on that every single second?
Every day. And seriously, listen, I mean, like, in a way, it sounds kind of trivial, but, you know, Donald Trump's conception of politics is purely like on the TV level anyway. And it does sound like the kind of thing where maybe you bust somebody's chops about this once or twice and let it go. But then again, on the other hand, I mean, if you really knew someone in your life, your friend Debbie or whoever, had spent their whole life pretending to be an Indian when they weren't an Indian, like, that is actually pretty, you know, contemptible behavior. That is really pretty ugly. And, you know, it's funny because it seems like, so far outside of the, it's just a thing or whatever. But I read a thing at, I guess, the Huffington Post by an Indian woman saying, you know, hey, let me tell you the real story about this. All right. Elizabeth Warren's family came and kicked Indians off of their land in Oklahoma, the last real Indian territory, when they opened it to white settlement. And they came and they robbed these people. And then her great grandfather or somebody had even written a book called Living Among the Indians. And writing about what it was like to be an Anglo family living among the Indians in Oklahoma. But then his granddaughter, just, which I guess is her mom, or maybe it was just his daughter, decided to just go around going, no, we are Indians. Yeah, that's right. Look at me. I'm an Indian. Like the Italian guy in the crying Indian pollution commercial, you know? And then so Elizabeth Warren just ran with this her whole life long, even though she's as pale as I am. You know, even in computer light, never had a clue that, you know, apparently went on. And I mean, I think it's pretty obvious to anyone that, yeah, she must have known that she was fronting all along, like that Rachel Dolezal lady pretending to be the head of the local NAACP up there in Washington or whatever. You can't do that kind of thing. So the fact that she's the strongest Democrat, and by the way, she's horrible on just about everything in terms of, like, she's very much a corporatist. So you go, well, at least she's not a socialist. Yeah, no, she's more of a fascist. She's more of a Barack Obama bailout for bankers type that they can rely on, and you can rely on that. And, you know, she's left enough to placate some left wingers, I guess. But otherwise she just wants structural control over the economy, you know, more than before, which is just fine with big business, of course. And, you know, she's relatively good on Afghanistan, but like with Donald Trump, I wouldn't count on her. And, you know, especially if a bunch of big bad generals come and start telling her what to do, I think she'll roll right over for him. So she'd be a horrible president, I'm sure. And she probably is the strongest candidate they got. I mean, look at Kamala Harris. It's ridiculous, dude, on so many levels. and you know, all the rest of them too. They're all just a bunch of dropouts waiting to happen here.
Yeah, it's funny because I would always say that I would think Kamala would get the nomination just because of, you know, how she looked, which I guess is like very best way to look at it. But oh, they're saying they want this and that.
Says that they want like a woman.
Yeah.
Woman. Oh, the DNC wanted her. You know, yeah, the Democrat Party leadership, she was certainly the chosen, you know, Hillary Clinton here. But the fact that she just has no charisma whatsoever. I mean, she's just a horrible person. And she has "I'm a horrible person" written all over her face. There's just no way around that.
Especially, in the debate when Tulsi was just harping on her about, you know, her criminal justice record. It was like, and she was just taken, you know, you could just tell like.
She looks so mad.
Yeah, because her demeanor throughout before all that was like, oh, I got this in the bag.
Yeah.
Number I'm going to win this debate 100%. And then this bitch comes out and talks shit about my record. Oh, how dare you?
And she and it was a kill shot too. She goes, look, this guy was an innocent man on death row and she refused to let him have access to the evidence to prove his guilt or let him demonstrate it to the court until she was made to. I mean, that sounds a lot to me like she was trying to murder an innocent man.
Yeah, and that's
you can dress that up however you want, but
right, and that's why that's that meme of her, you know, being a cop because that's what she is. She was a cop. I'm sorry, but that's what she is, you know.
Yep.
And then, you know, the other candidate that we haven't talked about is Bernie Sanders, and of course, you know what happened to him in 2016. I mean, he just got fucking, you know, his heart just taken from him, you know, with the DNC or whatever. I mean, what's to say that's not going to happen to him again if he gets...
Yeah, and he didn't have the momentum this time. I mean, last time, people were desperate to have an alternative to Hillary, and he fit the bill there. Mm-hmm. And honestly, I think if the DNC had let him go ahead, if they had released their super delegates and said, look, man, you guys can support Bernie if you want to, go ahead and give him the nomination, I think he'd have beat Trump by 10 points. Because I think he would have said, he's smart enough that he would have said, look, I'm not going to nationalize American industry, okay? I'm just going to steal more money from rich people and give it to you. Vote Democrat. And he would have won by 10 points. Because you know what? He's bad on trade in the same way as Trump. And that's what the people wanted. Hmm. And the free trade agreements and raise up protectionism. And now Trump is more interested in the owners and Sanders is more interested in the workers. But they're both on the supply side of the equation. Screw the customer on behalf of the producers. And so they agree with that. And, you know, there were some Reagan Democrats. In other words, Democrats who were like union employee types who went and voted for Trump because Hillary Clinton represented NAFTA, which her husband had passed in the first place, and which she had supported as a senator and had supported the TPP and all these things. And Trump was promising protectionism. Well, if it had been Sanders, he would have been promising that same protectionism. Only he's not Donald Trump, the raving lunatic and ridiculous boob. And so Sanders would have had a huge advantage. But now he's in a field with 20 other people and he's 4 years older and he was already old as hell.
Right.
And for the last 4 years, boy, the left has really worn out this whole communism thing where everybody's already over it. It was kind of a fad back 4 years ago. But now I think people are already on the downside of that. And so they're looking more toward, you know, and it, you know, I don't know. And also you have to say it's worth mentioning. I don't know exactly what all is the problem, but it sure seems like the absolute and total lack of leftist excitement about or even liberal and progressive excitement about Tulsi Gabbard is a really poor reflection on them. You know, I have a whole rap about how she ain't really good enough. But boy, oh boy, she's by far the best of all of them. And especially at being able to articulate, like, what exactly is wrong with our Syria policy? She really understands in a way these others don't. And they don't like her at all. They don't care about her at all. That wins her apparently no points with the Democrat rank and file whatsoever.
I don't think she's Russia or something.
Oh yeah. Oh, Putin loves you or whatever. Yeah.
Assad.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Assad. Yeah. There you go. Yeah.
Right. I mean, because of course she was in Iraq War II, right. And so when Obama took Al Qaeda's side in Syria, she was like, "Wait, what?" Because she understood who was who over there, right? So she wasn't really siding with Assad. She was siding against Al Qaeda in Iraq in Syria. And she was trying to highlight, look, the law that she tried to pass was called the Stop Arming Terrorists Act. Mm-hmm. And that was why she went over there, was to try to highlight the fact that America was on the side of Al-Qaeda against a secular state, not to champion the greatness of Bashar al-Assad, but just to say, look, man, he wears a three-piece suit and shaves his chin. These guys do the head choppings and the suicide bombings and say out loud that they are blood oath sworn loyal to Ayman al-Zawahiri, the leader of Al-Qaeda, the butcher of New York City. So who are you going to choose in that one? The guy that used to torture these guys for Bill Clinton and George Bush? Or the actual guys, the terrorists themselves? And Obama took the side of the terrorists, and John Brennan, the traitor, took the side of the terrorists, and Tulsi Gabbard. And you know what? It is her fault that when they attack her for this, when she does get an interview, and they go, oh, how come you love Assad so much? She does not shove it back down their throat. She does not go, look, dude, let me explain something to you, all right, and nail it. Instead, she lets them put her back on the defensive, and it makes it sound like, well, you're right, I guess I did suck up to that one dictator that one time, but don't hold it against me, which is a total terrible take, you know, and it concedes all this ground to her political opponents that they do not deserve to have. And you know what? I think if she would come out and go, I want to bring all the troops home from everywhere and call it the whole terror war, and it's all BS, and give us a full-scale Ron Paulian anti-war line, I think she would do much better. I think probably there are a lot of people who, on the liberal side, who don't support her because they don't care that she's a dove, doesn't impress them at all, and they don't like other things about her or whatever it is. And then there are people who are doves, and they go, eh, she's too hawkish, though. She wants to stop arming terrorists, sure, but she still wants to keep fighting them forever and ever. And that's not quite good enough, which is my position, of course. And I think if she would, she needs to, you know, stop trying to split the difference like Rand Paul and go ahead and choose one and be it. You're either a hawk or you're not. And, you know, the premise of the whole terror war is as bogus as the war for the terrorists in places like Libya and Syria anyway. So we ought to call the whole thing off here, there, and both wars in Yemen are illegitimate and should be canceled, in other words. And she should be brave enough to say that and bright enough to understand that. But still, the fact that she has no momentum whatsoever, and what does that say about the left half? Never mind the leftists, but like the left half of American political society, that the anti-war veteran can't get, you know, better than a couple percent in any of these polls. It's a real shame. It's a real bad reflection on them.
Yeah. So we'll go ahead and end it there. Cool. Yeah, I really appreciate you coming on, Scott, to, you know, talk about Trump and all that, I don't know, all the good stuff about him. You know, I'm joking, of course.
Yeah.
I know that you have your Libertarian Institute website, which is a frequent visit for me, antiwar.com, another frequent visit. And then, of course, your podcast that you have, that you've done over 5,000 interviews now, which is just, that's an incredible achievement. Took a long time, I'm sure, you know, obviously, but
15 years.
Yeah. So.
Let me plug some books.
Oh, yeah, sure. Go ahead.
Well, so I wrote this book, Fool's Errand, which I'm sure everyone has already read. Audiobooks available about Afghanistan. But then this year we published at the Libertarian Institute, the great William Norman Grigg, our friend and co-founder of the Institute, who died a couple years ago. We published his last book. Actually, that's not true. We got one more coming out, but it's called No Quarter. And it's great. I really want you guys to read it. I know you'll love it, man. It's so good. It is really good. I'm not just saying that for the $6 or whatever, you know, and in fact, his family gets all the money.
Yeah, we actually have a copy. And I know on your recommendation, we interviewed Thomas Edlam.
Oh, great. Oh, that's right. That's right. Yeah. It's so, so good. I mean, it really is a great book. I know you'll love it. And then also, so this week, it's got to be this week, man, or I'm running away from home. This week, we are publishing The Great Ron Paul, The Scott Horton Show Interviews, 2004 through 2019. All those transcripts and a great book. And it's really great. You're going to love that too. And then also this week, if I could possibly swing it, we're really trying hard to get this stuff under the wire here. We're going to put out Sheldon Richman's book, Why Palestine Matters. And actually, it looks like we're going to have to change the title because Mondo Weiss just published a book called that. Dope. So,
damn it.
Anyway, but it's a Sheldon Richman book about Palestine, and it's so good. And it's going to change everybody who reads its mind, unless they're already good on it, in which case it won't. But it's a collection of essays that he wrote between 1989 and 94, and then through, and then again, 2014 through 19, something like that. So really, really great stuff there by Sheldon Richman. And it will be the definitive libertarian take on Israel-Palestine. And so both of those books should be out this week. So that'll be at libertarianinstitute.org.
All right. Well, again, thank you so much, Scott, for joining us. And yeah, all the things that he said, all the books, all the websites, Nor Quarter, The Ravens of William Norman Greig. I kept cutting you off, so I kind of wanted to say the name again.
Oh, sorry.
But I talked too much. No, it's fine. That's okay. But yeah, so again, thanks everyone for listening and watching, and yeah, have a good night, everyone. Thank you, Scott, for joining us.
Thank you, guys. Good night.
All right. Bye, everyone.
Now you know what's happening. Thanks for listening. If you want to support the show, go to hapasupremacy.com and follow our social media. Have a great day.